Hello and welcome to this pre-recorded millennial for 2018. This is with Darkest Sky, who is a musician who has emerged in the last 6 months or so on YouTube, and I love his stuff, and I think a lot of people do, but I think maybe not enough people are aware of his material yet. So hopefully, I want to hopefully get more exposure to Darkest Sky. So welcome to Millennial.
Oh, thank you, Woz. It's really nice to be here, and thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And you've been really good to me so far, like pumping me up. So that's great. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I wanted to, when I first heard your songs, I think the first one I heard was Tyrant Spell, and I thought, bloody hell, this is really good. And it feels, well, how would you describe your music if you were to, like, give it in one sentence?
Well, it's the genre is neo folk, but I see the songs as just being like little dreams, little dreamscapes. Particularly if people watch the accompanying videos as well. I'm trying to just give people an impression of what's going on in the world, as opposed to being literal and using the past as a way of doing that. Because I don't want to just come out and just be, too obvious. So, and I think it affects people more as well. Like dreams can really affect you, so
Oh
that's.
yeah, I mean, it feels like it's very rooted in English history and just being in England. That's how that comes across really powerfully throughout all of the songs that I've heard.
Oh yeah, it's the magic of the English countryside, definitely. And where I live in Essex, there's so many folk tales, and I mean, it's witch country, so it's really just it's amazing how many stories you can find, and the history is just so rich. So that's what I tried to put across. So I'm really pleased that you said that it came across like that. That's good.
Oh, absolutely does. But of course, the interesting thing is that you're not a rural. You came from London originally, didn't you? So you grew up in a huge city.
Oh yes, yeah. I was born in South London, so you can't get much more urban than that. And yeah, it's very different to where I am now. I mean, it's kind of semi-rural where I am now, so it's not entirely countryfied. I'd love to go and live right out in the wilds at some point in time, but.
Well, the reason I mentioned that was because I was going to ask, when you were growing up, and obviously London has changed in ways that we don't need to go on about here because we all know. But even growing up, did you miss the countryside? Did you feel that living in a city was stifling or artificial or anything like that? Or did you, or was it just normal and fine to you?
No, the only time I started to feel that way, and this probably sounds mad, but it was when I read Lord of the Rings for the first time, because that was the first time I ever started thinking about, the countryside. And I think we went on holiday to Cornwall while I was reading it at the first time, and I started
Oh, that
thinking,
would fit nicely.
yeah. And I was kind of going, oh, must be amazing. But no, I was just so, it was just wheels going round and cement and concrete, and that's all I knew, really. Didn't even see a butterfly, I don't think, until I was 15.
Bloody hell.
yeah, horrible place, South London. Well, I shouldn't say that, really, because probably some people might be living there still, but unfortunately for them. But
Well, yeah, I think there will still be some people in South London who watch my videos.
No, I mean, there's probably some, it has some redeeming features, obviously, but I think it's just gradually getting worse and worse. Like you said, we know why and we know what's going on, so it's just.
Well, that brings us to this, to your story. I mean, you started off as a leftist.
So, sorry, people. I
Well,
was
so did I. I
just.
mean, so did loads of us. So why don't you tell that story?
Okay, well, I wasn't really deeply immersed in politics, to be honest with you. I was just like a kind of wishy-washy leftist, and just went along with all the usual stuff that those sort of people go along with, and was just a bit stupid, really. But when I left London, two things happened at the same time. My old band split up, and I left London in 2012, because we couldn't afford to live there anymore. It was just too expensive. And I went into a really bad depression for quite some time. So it was either just go under and sink into the abyss of this misery, or I did what I've always done, which was I started writing. And it started off and it just turned into a book. And we decided to do a farewell tour with my band. So we
Well,
did.
let's talk about that book first. What kind of stuff was it?
Well, it was basically, I hit upon the idea of writing the biography of an imaginary musician, but it was very much based on me. And I had the idea of having the biographer really disapprove of the person he was writing about. He didn't agree with his politics. He didn't agree with anything he stood for. He didn't like the way he lived his life. And I did that to create tension, so I could have these two, the biographer, you know, he would write about what the musician had done, and then he'd be going, oh, this is disgraceful and such and such. And I started out agreeing with the musician because it was basically pretty much, I suppose, 75% me. And so then
I suppose then it started off as an attempt to defend your worldview.
Yeah, it was definitely justification. Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely right. And but by the third draft, I found myself really agreeing with the biographer and completely disagreeing with the musician and thinking that he was an idiot. And but it was kind of almost like alchemy. It was like a magical process, because in writing this book, I had these very real problems and I had this imaginary solution by writing the book, and this new person emerged from it and I was completely different. And once I'd done that, we did this farewell tour, and that's how I managed to sell a few copies of it, because we did a crowdfunding thing for the album, and the book was given away as one of the prizes, or whatever you call it, not prizes. I can't think of the word now, but anyway.
Rewards.
Yeah, rewards, that's right, yeah, so rewards. So it was given away as that. So I think I probably shifted about 150 of them. It wasn't like a massive amount. But anyway, so my worldview had changed, but outwardly I was still surrounded by all these people that were all, you know, like the SJWs, I suppose. And when Brexit happened, I was like, yeah, that's quite good, really, but I was still, you know, playing the party line and going, oh, you know. Then Trump came along and I was going, yeah, that's good. And then obviously then I started watching people like yourself and Way of the World and the Iconoclast and that. And I was really amenable to the ideas that you guys were saying. Whereas 18 months before, before I'd written the book, I wouldn't have given you house room. And so the whole process began and I started to be able to understand stuff. Then obviously I did, like, you know, started watching loads of videos like everyone does, and I just went down the rabbit hole, and now I'm kind of fully on board with what everybody's talking about. So,
what was the response from your old fans to this book?
Well, I think it was, to be honest with you, probably confusion, because it needed editing. It was like the typical first book. I just put everything but the kitchen sink into it. And so they probably didn't really understand. It wasn't, and it didn't come to any major conclusions. It was just too confusing, really. It was just too much in it, really. So I don't think that, but I've had a reaction more since I've started doing this band and I've started talking about stuff. And I went back onto Facebook, and to start with, I had about 400 of the old people from the old band, and this is no word of a lie, I've now got 35 people left.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Some of them I got rid of, some of them just naturally went. But they were all those kind of people. They were all sort of lefties, always arguing with me about stuff about, you know, immigration or migration or whatever. And gradually, slowly but surely, it was just been like, you know, they're dropping like flies. And I've had, you know, quite a few bad arguments and stuff. But now I've got lots of new people and lots of new friends. So it's like, but I have to say, a couple of the people that used to follow the old band, a couple of them are my patrons now as well, so that's quite nice of them. And they've stuck with me. But it's like a handful of people, really. That's it.
That's interesting. But how did the book and then that concert, and then had you discovered the Dissident Right on YouTube at that point, or was that still to come?
No, not when I did the book or when we did the final tour. I was just on my own. I just changed my opinions. And another thing that also added to it was the fact that I started tracing my family history on Ancestry. And I'd never done that before. And I had no idea about how far back my family went or how deep my roots were in England, because you were saying about England and stuff like that. And I found out so many amazing things. And there was one particular instance. It was my maternal grandmother. Her mother had died very young, and she had to bring up all the very young children, so she was like their mother, really, and she was proud of them. And one of them, Bill, his name was, he went to Canada, and he eventually ended up becoming the mayor in a place called Sioux Lookout. And I was researching him, and I found him in this article. It was, well, it was actually written for somebody's PhD, and it was to do with the schools over there. I can't remember what they call them now. But there's a whole thing going on in Canada with the Native Indians or the Native Canadians. The
First Nations people.
Yeah, First Nations, that's it. And in the sort of 40s and 50s, they were trying to make them be able to fit into Western culture. So they used to tell residential schools, that's what they were called. So anybody who might listen to this that's in Canada, I know the story about the residential schools. And they're seen as this dreadful thing now, this appalling thing. And there's whole loads of articles and videos being made about how terrible they were. But my uncle was the mayor, and he was behind, there was this particular basketball team, and he took them on tour. And they took these kids, and they were helping them, really. And they built an ice rink at the school and all this sort of stuff. But in this PhD, it was just all, you know, bash the white man, typical stuff. And the guy who'd written it, like, he was all right. But the woman who was behind it, when I did a little bit of digging into her, she was behind all the protests about cultural appropriation of Indian clothing and stuff like that in the Olympics. And she's like a typical Marxist professor and really... you know, just like out to get people. So I actually wrote to, because I'm a bit OCD, I start writing to everybody, and I was going, are you saying that this person was to blame for any of this stuff, or have you any evidence? And in the end, I actually got her to, she wrote back to me and said, oh, no, I don't think so. So I said, oh, right, okay. But I think I worried them, actually, because even the university wrote to me. But I just got the bit between my teeth, because I thought, how dare you start saying about this stuff about someone who had done nothing wrong, and yet you're like, he's in an article, because obviously it's so long ago, this was in 1953. They obviously thought that no one would care about this now, you know. But
yeah, of course. But then somebody related to the guy got in touch with them.
Yeah, I think it scared them, actually. And so because I wouldn't let it go, I did send quite a lot of emails. And but you know, I mean, so that was a personal thing. That was my personal experience of somebody who we just saw as a poor kid from South London who went out to Canada. You know, he flew across the, he was like flying planes across the Rockies, and he did all sorts of crazy stuff, and he became the mayor, and he owned a garage out there. He did really well for himself. And my nan, I can just about remember, she was always going like, oh, you know, she was so proud of him. And yet you've got these people now writing, talking as if he was garbage, you know, and it really, really annoyed me.
Yeah, I'm sure. But, I mean, I can well understand why it would, because you think you feel a protective urge towards your relatives.
Yeah, and but that's
when you'd heard about them when you were a child.
But that's a strange thing. I've never felt like that before. And then I was looking at all these ancestors, and I really did. I'm not making this up. I really felt like a bond that I'd never had before, and that I wouldn't have done, like, 2 or 3 years ago. I wouldn't have bothered. I'd have probably gone, oh well, he probably was like a, you know, mad character or something. But no, I definitely felt that change. And that's, I think that's really important. I think that's something that, obviously, like, as you know, that's the thing that everyone's lacking.
I think you're right. I mean, this is going to differ from one individual to the next. The importance, or the potential importance, that their ancestors can have for them. But it is something that has been reported to me by numerous people, that when they became red-pilled, and simultaneously, or as a result of that, they started looking into their ancestry and genealogy, and then discovered that, you know, that they were related to this or that person who did this or that, and it suddenly becomes real and important to them, and they start integrating it into their sense of themselves.
Yeah, that's true. But what's weird is the fact that how easily everyone just is... it takes for granted the fact that, oh, I'm just on my own, I'm just a person, I've got my one life. And that's what makes people not look into the future as well. They just don't care.
Oh, absolutely. But this is the contrast, isn't it? We have this culture, this way of being now, which is very, you are an individual, and you live in the moment, and you're going to have 70 years or so. You're not connected to anything else, really.
Yeah, you don't care, and you don't care about what's going to come after your little lifespan. And of course, then, you know, that's reflected in politics, because politicians and that only care about the next 5 years. No one thinks ahead, because it's not important to people. And then you take it further than that. Everybody's so distracted with all the technology and just, you know, the bread and circuses that no one's paying any attention to what's going on. And it's a real process that you go through. And I mean, obviously talking to people who know this, but it's quite strange when you kind of really feel like a completely different person, and you feel connected to something that you didn't feel connected to before. And and that's why I started doing, one of the reasons why I started doing the songs, because I thought, you know, I've got to help other people, maybe, or at least encourage people or console them or have music, because I think music's very important.
We'll get onto that in a wee while. First, I want to make sure that I've got the sort of timeline correct. I'm a wee bit OCD about this stuff. Forgive me if I'm being pedantic. So after the tour and so on, you were still yet to discover The Distant Right. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah, I did. I left London in 2012, and then I wrote the book between 2013-14. We did the tour in 15, and I'd changed, but I hadn't started to do anything about it.
Yeah, it sounds like you were sort of waiting for something else now.
Yeah, I think I was, because I was just on my own. I didn't, you know, I'm a pretty solitary person. I don't really mix with people that much anyway. I'm a pretty miserable bugger. So I was just on my own with it. So I found that just watching videos or reading stuff and that, I started to think, oh, this is interesting. But like I say, I know for a fact I wouldn't have been interested in it before. So it just happened at the right time. I think that's what happens. People come into your life at the right time. Things come into your life at the right time when you're ready for them, I think, sometimes. I don't think that's why I think when people say, oh, we've got to get more people on our side and we've got to red pill more people. But I think that can only happen when they're ready for it. I don't think you can force it. You've got to try, obviously, but I think sometimes you can get people to a certain point and then they won't go any further.
Yeah, I mean, you can, what's the word, the expression, bring a heart. But it's a mix of both. I mean, if people have never heard this stuff or these ideas or whatever, then it won't really occur to them that they should change, unless some sort of personal crisis makes them, you know, look for something new.
But
in other people, you can just sort of introduce this to them and they realize, oh yeah, that is of relevance to me, and you know, it's a new door for them.
Yeah, it probably depends on where they've come from and like what their background is. I mean, I think a lot of it is quite different coming from London, because obviously London's been ahead of the curve with all this stuff, because years, you know, things have been bad in London for an awful long time. And I think the rest of the country's sort of caught up, sadly. But I just used to take everything for granted. You do. It's just what you grow up with is what you're used to. You just think that's normal and you don't take any notice of it. And then all of a sudden you start going, you might go on holiday somewhere and you go, of course, it's not like South London around here. It's actually quite nice here. You know, you don't have to sort of, you're not going to get kicked down the stairs on the bus or something. Like that.
Well, you see, one of the things about London is that it clearly used to be a place where many stories have taken place. And now that the people who, the descendants of the people who took part in those stories have now been driven out of London, and therefore all of these stories of old Cockneys and upper class people and middle class, whatever, all those stories are now being forgotten, just as the communities in which they happened have evaporated. In a way, London is a sort of prototype for what's now happening all over Britain. Like this old history is being forgotten because the people who would have sustained it have been dispossessed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you look at the old Victorian buildings and you can imagine people living there and the way they would have lived their lives. But it's like walking onto like an old film set that's been abandoned. And now there's different stories happening there, and it's got no relationship to what used to happen there before. I mean, it's like I found out I had quite a lot of family that lived in Kennington, and they owned shops there and stuff like that. This was in the 1870s, 1880s. And there was a whole clan of them that lived around Kennington and Lambeth and that area. But there's nothing left now. There's no one left there. There's nothing. It's all gone. And it's really sad. It's horrible, really.
It certainly is. I mean, it's dreadful. But the reason I use the word stories is that, well, that links back to your music, which seems quite story based in a sense. So you discovered the Dissident Right on YouTube, Me, Way of the World, and so on. And then what?
I thought, well, I want to do something, because obviously just for my own sanity, I wanted to do something anyway. I wanted to be doing music because that's just basically what I do. That's who I am. I have to be creative, otherwise go mad. So, and I thought, well, I want to do something that's going to be my part in it. But I didn't want to do a channel where I was just talking, because that was my first idea. I thought, well, maybe I could do a channel and just kind of, you know, do a similar to what you do, I suppose. But I thought, well, that's not really what I should be doing. I should be doing something with music, because that's what I've spent all these years learning about. And I did, you know, I've done literally hundreds of gigs and you know, I've done loads of stuff. So I should do something with it, because it's pointless. This is just all going to be a waste if I don't.
And so also, just before you get onto this, I happen to know that you've had lots of equipment for decades, and you have reused it like here and there, and then you reused it for this new project and found new ways to use it.
Yeah, I've got like some old, really old synths, Roland Juno 60 that I've had for years, and
didn't you explain about the, was it 4-track recorders or 8-track?
Oh yes, I've got an old Tascam 4-track. What I tried to do is I tried to make everything sound gritty and grainy and old. So sometimes I put the clean sounds of the synthesizer down onto the tape to make it sound warmer, put it all through just like loads of effects and stuff like that. I mean, I was doing before I did this, I was just mixing another track and I was putting some extra stuff on it, and I put it all onto a cassette and then slowed the pitch down, and then re-recorded it back in again. It's an effect you can't get digitally. You just can't do it otherwise. It just gives it a fat, makes the drum sound really fat. I can't explain it, but it just, yeah, just like messing about with stuff. And I'm fortunate that I can spend all day doing it, so that's what I do.
It sounds really fun.
Yeah. So, but I have to admit, I did do, before I did this thing, I did an experiment. I did the most extreme, ludicrous kind of music that I could possibly do, and with the imagery of it. Just because I knew for a fact that people that had already begun, people were getting banned, and you're always seeing people saying, oh, you know, YouTube's taken this down, or this has been banned. So I thought, I wonder how far you can go. So I did it, and I'm not joking, I had 40 subscribers on this other thing that I was doing, and they started taking the videos down. So that taught me a very, very good lesson. I thought, right, okay, so you've got to be a bit more subtle. you know, so I wish I wanted to be anyway, but it's just, I thought, right, okay, that's definitely not going to do that. If you do that kind of thing, that's going to get you canned. So I tried to be subtle now, but there's all sorts of little things in the tracks that you could pick up on, or I could explain to people, but I'm not going to, because it just seeps into them, you know. So but I'm trying to be careful, obviously, because it's, you know, you do all this work, and it's, well, I don't need to tell you, you've had so much of it yourself, haven't you? You know,
yeah. So tell people more about the songs then, finally, because I know I've sort of held you back from that, because I wanted to tell the chronology and so on first, but talk about the songs.
Okay, well, I always just start with a title. I've always done that. I always start with a song title, and Tyrant Spell, actually, I had that title. I think it comes from a poem. I can't remember who it was. I think it was one of the Brontes. I think it was from one of their poems. I can't remember. But so I just always start with that. Then I just have a little chord sequence. I sit out in the garden shed, so I don't annoy everyone warbling away. And so I get the vocal melodies. And then I'll write the lyrics, and the whole concept of the thing was based on the idea of Doggerland, which, if people don't know, is the sunken land beneath the North Sea, which is sometimes called the British Atlantis. And the reason I wanted to use this whole story was, because I could have done the sort of Lord of the Rings thing, but that's been done too many times. Well, not too many times, but it has been done a lot in music. And also, plus the fact, because the story of Lord of the Rings is so well known, you can't really take liberties with it. So I wanted my own little creation myth. So I thought, well, okay, I'll set this world, all these imaginary people that I've made up. Some of them are based on, sort of pagan stuff, but a lot of it's just my own imagination. And the reason I wanted to do it in Doggerland was because of obviously the idea of this place being flooded and disappearing, and that's kind of how we all feel. We feel like we're all disappearing and sinking, and so you can use that quite obvious idea of the waves coming over us and then just expand it into this whole world. So all the songs are basically linked to that in one way or another, but then sometimes, like the song I just did recently, was about a local wizard who was here in 1876, I think it was. He died, but he was like a local, I don't know what you'd call him, like a cunning man, that's what he was called. It was like just sort of local wizard. So that's not really connected to Dogland, but I managed to make it conflate in with Woden or Odin or whatever you want to call them. And so all the songs are all linked to that kind of stuff. So I basically wanted to create my own world, really. I suppose that's what I'm trying to say. I created my own little world, and it's not really, I'm not trying to be, I'm make no claims to be historically accurate, or I'm not trying to be scientific about it or be scholarly. It's all imaginary, it's all fantasy. And like I said at the start, you've got to think of it, they're like dreams. And when sometimes you'll have a dream and you'll go, what was that trying to tell me? And it just makes no sense, but it will make sense to you on the level of symbols. And that's what I'm trying to use, symbolism and the mixture of sounds and images and ideas to try and put what I know is behind it. And hopefully I'm not making it too esoteric or too obscure. I don't know.
I don't think so at all. I think that what you do is fantastic. I wouldn't say that if I didn't mean it, because obviously it's gushing praise and it could be insincere. But in the case of your music, I'm not insincere at all. I think what you're succeeding in doing is sort of stitching together a fabric that is a version of England. It's a fantastical version of England, but of course, by being fantastical, it illuminates things that are not visible in the everyday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I'm trying to make it that I'm trying to shine a weird light on things so people can see things from a different angle that perhaps they wouldn't actually think. And also, obviously, the other problem that we all face, as we know, is the fact that history is being rewritten for us, and that's really important. I think it's important for everybody to look into their local folk tales and their local history, and particularly sometimes if you've got local historians who've maybe published their own books and stuff, because often those people will talk about things that people who are working for big publishing houses won't, because obviously they're following some kind of agenda, and or they'd be told, oh, you can't have that in the book, that's ridiculous or whatever. Whereas sometimes you find old books that are written by some weird character that you go, I never knew that. Like, for example, around here there's a where I live, there was a huge community of houseboats between the First World War and the Second World War. It grew up because people were, like now, people didn't have anywhere to live and didn't have a lot of money during the Depression, I guess. And there was about 1,500 of them at one point. And I find this whole place fascinating, the mystique of this place, because it's not there anymore. It was all along the creeks and marshes. And after the Second World War, the council had enough of these people not paying any money to them, so they just moved in and set fire to most of the houseboats. And
in hell,
yeah, they evicted everyone. I think quite a lot of people have moved away because of the war. Some people obviously had died perhaps as well, but they set them on fire. I mean, they were all different types. So some of them were little tugboats, they're all sorts, some of them were quite amazing two-story things with gardens built into them and all sorts of stuff. They were huge, and this whole thing just was there, and now it's vanished. That was actually in the book. I put that in the book that I wrote as well, because I was so fascinated by this mysterious place that literally just started after the First World War ended because people didn't have anywhere to live.
And I guess that those people got housed in by the council in, you know, concrete blocks after the Second World War.
Yeah, exactly. That was just before they moved all the people along there and put them into council houses. And then the council started buying up all the properties and knocking them down. There was a lot of 16th century builders in the area where I live that they purposely let go into rack and ruin so they could demolish them because they were planning to build a huge road, which never came to be in the end. But yeah, that's just what they do. They don't want anybody. And it's always the same thing. If common people build something for themselves, it will always be destroyed from above. That's what always happens. And that's not left or right politics. That's just the way of the world. That's just the way things are, you know. So things like that are fascinating. And also the fact that another thing in this area is the marshes and the land around it. It's where the peasants' revolt actually began as well. And so there's always been a history of people being pissed off with the powers that be, I think. So that's interesting.
And you're keeping that tradition going?
Yes, yeah, hopefully, yeah. So I'm quite revolting and I'm probably a peasant, so yeah.
I remember in the more dignified sense, but yeah, that'll do.
yeah. So yeah, I'm trying to keep the tradition going. Yeah, but that's what I mean. So all over the country, every person that's got their own little folk stories and tales and myths and legends, and you should, you know, that's what we need to keep. We've got to hold on to that. It's like holding on to what your parents or your grandparents have told you stories about when they were kids. You've got to hold on to it, because when you're young, you just go, oh yeah, I'm not interested now, I've got to go and do this latest thing or whatever, you know. But and then when you get a bit older, you go, oh damn, I wish I'd paid more attention to what they were telling me, like, you know, because it was so interesting. But that's, you know, that's just the way you are when you're interested in going out and getting drunk, I suppose, or something, and not listening to what people are telling you. But all those old stories are still there, and we have to keep hold of them, because we are being brainwashed now. You know, it's like that. Obviously, we're undergoing psychological attack every day, and part of it is that they're destroying all our history and taking it away from us.
What is, and I'm going to ask an extremely broad and open question here. What, and the answer would seem to be very, very obvious, but I want to hear it in your terms. What is the importance of a people's history?
Well, it is them, isn't it? It's basically that's them. Because if you don't know who you are, you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going. And once you, and that's what's happened to us, we don't know where we're going. So people have stopped having children, just given up, and just think, oh, you know, I'll just buy a car and drive really fast and do loads of coke at the weekends, and just, you know, and people have just become vacuous. And the people's history is the tradition of what your people are. Is what keeps things safe, I suppose, in a way, and keeps people on the right track. And we've been pushed off the track, and we know why and how. We've been pushed off the track because, you know, you're more easily manipulated when you become like that, and everybody's just like empty-headed and going around doing things. And it's the same thing, I suppose. It's like feminism made, you know, women sort of like go, I'm not listening to what my father told me. And your father might be saying to you, well, you really don't want to get involved with that guy you're involved with because he's a waster. He's useless and he's going to ruin your life. No, I won't be told. And then everything goes down the pan. And that's just one example of how all these things happen, you know. So it's like, as soon as tradition crumbles, everything just falls to pieces. So that's why you have to hang on to your history. But now we have to hang on to it because obviously we're facing in the next few decades, God knows what. So it's going to be really important to us because it's kind of like a shield against the outside forces, I think.
That's a great answer. All right. So is there anything else you'd like to say about the music?
Well, one thing I do want to say is I want to thank my patrons who are fantastic. And I want to thank everybody that helps me. And you particularly have helped me hugely.
Well, you were very good to me when I got banned from Twitter. You were very enthusiastic about, you know, fighting that.
Oh, the Wednesday woes. Yeah.
Wednesday
full of woes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think people should stick together. And it saddens me sometimes, but I see people can expend enormous amounts of energy bickering about things, but they won't spend the same energy sticking together. And this is a huge problem. It's so annoying because I don't know what it is with people, but they just can argue about anything.
Well, I mean, I could write a book about this, honestly. I mean, let's not go into that just here, because bring the thing down.
Yeah, okay.
There is absolutely a need for solidarity. I mean, I think you and I can certainly agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wish that would be my wish for next year, that everybody becomes, less argumentative with each other and starts realizing that you've got to start sticking together. And all these things that we've had arguments about in the past, yeah, well, we can sort it out later, but we need to worry about what's going to happen because we're running out of time. So,
yeah. So that was linked from thanking your patrons.
I'm just going to keep pumping the songs out as much as I can, because I just want to keep, because that's my way of staying sane, and I want to try and help people. But I've also, at your suggestion, I've come up, or you came up with the idea of maybe doing some ambient soundscapes and getting some guests to read out snippets from the book that I've, because there's a booklet that goes with the Songs of Darkest Sky, which my patrons get, which sort of fleshes out the whole world behind it a bit more, and also to little character, what would you call it? I don't know.
Sketches.
Yeah, that's the word. Yeah, character sketches of the different characters that appear in the songs and things like that. And you very graciously agreed to do the first one. So.
Well, yeah, I'll do it. I mean, I came up with the idea. I was watching one of your videos, and I thought, I wonder if he's going to go in this direction. And so I think I asked you, and you said you hadn't thought of it.
So yeah, that's right.
I mean, I'm glad that I was able to, help you there.
No, it's good. No, it's great, because I think I would never have got to that, because I think I would just keep thinking, oh no, I'll have to just do another song, and keep the momentum going, because that's always a problem. It's like when you do a band and you release albums and things like that, you've always got that thing, if you get something that seems popular or people seem to like, you kind of go, oh, I don't want to change the recipe too much, because it might, people might not like it. I've done a couple of like instrumentally things, but no, I never would have thought of doing that. I think it's going to be really good. Now I'm hoping that I can get some other people to do things. I'd like to use people with different regional accents and things like that from the.
So, I mean, would you be interested in people contacting you, offering to do that?
I think if they feel that they could do it well, obviously, because the thing about yourself is obviously you're used to speaking, so it's kind of I don't want just people who are just going to do it and sort of be time wasters. So, but yeah, if somebody would like to do it and they think they do it well, it wouldn't be huge. It'd be like 2 or 3 minutes of recording, and then they just have to send me a little MP3 or something of them, and I can mess about with it and fit it to the music afterwards, obviously.
How can they contact you?
They can contact me either on Twitter or thedarkestsky@protonmail.com. The darkest sky, and it's capital T, capital D, capital S, so it's thedarkestsky@protonmail.com.
Right, all one word.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to find me, the best thing to do is just to go to the YouTube channel Darkest Sky, because all the links are on there. To everything else, really. I'm on everything, really. Facebook, the whole lot. But it's the usual story, Just probably spread yourself really thin on all these different things. So.
Touch wood for now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. Any closing words?
Well, I'd just like to really encourage people to not get too black-pilled. I think I've got a good feeling, and I also think that a lot of this people being banned and being made to feel like, well, basically, for all intents and purposes, people are being treated like criminals, and they're driving everybody out of everywhere. And I think it's actually forcing people to start meeting up in real life and to start organising and start doing things, because I think everybody's just sick to the back teeth of it. And I think it's actually going to, you know, it's going to have the opposite effect to the to what people expected it to. I think it's going to work against them in the end. And
yeah, I agree.
You know, I think, yeah, you know, there's some guys, I've joined a couple of little groups and things like that, and people are talking to each other. It's hard because obviously everybody's always really cautious and suspicious, and it's quite hard to meet people. Obviously, it's hard to meet people, particularly if you don't know them. And we've been made to live in this bloody climate of fear anyway, haven't we? So, it's, which I hate. And but you just got to take it, you know, a little step at a time, and try and reach out to people. Because I think the worst thing of all is the loneliness. And it must be terrible for somebody if they're completely just can't talk to anyone, and they can only be on the internet and stuff like that. But in real life, they can't talk to anyone because they're too scared they're going to lose their job or be doxxed or whatever's going to happen to them. And I also do think as well that, you know, obviously, if you can't show yourself, then don't, you know. And I would say to most people, if you're under 25, think very carefully about what you're going to do about anything, because, you know, you've got to think of your future. But I'm in a position where I'm, you know, I just do what I do. So I'm like you, I'm just out, I'm out in the open. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So. Okay, excellent. Well, let's leave it there then. And people can, I'll put the links in the description so people will be able to find you. And I hope, I hope more people enjoy your music as I do.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay, well, that's Darkest Sky. So thank you for coming on Millennial 2018. Okay.